This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know how we say all the time that the Fed is really running this economy? Maybe not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. August the 24th today, Tuesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today with a rare midweek version of our popular game show, What is Jay Powell Thinking? In five words or less. Except, Sabri Benishour is going to get a whole lot more than five words with which to answer, and here's why. Come the end of the week, Friday, Powell is going to be giving a big speech at the Fed's annual gathering in Jackson Hole. Central bankers and economists and researchers and financiers rubbing elbows virtually again this year. And the theme of the whole thing is macroeconomic policy in an uneven economy. But wrapped up in that not necessarily scintillating title is years of debate and controversy over who that policy has been serving in an economy where inequality has been growing for decades, and what Powell and the Fed can actually do about it. Here's Sabri.
The Fed's job is to keep the economy going. Hot enough so as many people as possible have jobs, but not so hot that we get too much inflation in the economy. But when we say the economy, whose economy are we talking about?
Black and brown workers live in an economy that we generally, as a country, would consider recession almost all the time.
Claudia Somm is a senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute. She's referring to the fact that black unemployment has been twice white unemployment for decades. Adam Posen is president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The Fed cannot, with the tools at its disposal, directly converge differences in unemployment rates or wage gaps.
The tools Posen is talking about amount, in a nutshell, to nudging interest rates. That's the equivalent of pressing the gas or tapping the brakes in the economy. It may not affect inequality directly, but it does affect it indirectly, because the longer the economy gets the gas, the more that disadvantaged people can benefit.
Don't let your foot off the gas before you get to the destination.
The concern in years past was that by applying the gas pedal for too long, the Fed might create inflation.
You're going to run off the road or blow out the engine.
But Posen says after the Great Recession, it became apparent that fear was overblown. Many more Americans could have been helped by a hotter economy during that period. Benjamin Dulcin directs the Fed Up campaign, which has been pushing the Fed to change its approach.
Like, it's great that the Fed is sort of acknowledging that they need to change their model, acknowledging their mistakes, but they've got a lot of deliberate damage to make up for.
Still, some question the idea that the Fed, keeping the gas pedal on for longer than it has in the past, will help Americans without summoning the specter of inflation. Anil Kashyap is a professor at the Booth School of Business.
There's no theoretical reason that it has to work this way. It's not proved, and there's no theory that says it has to be true.
But the Fed has very clearly taken some lessons from the last recession, and it's reasonable to expect that the foot on the national economic gas pedal will be a little heavier this time around. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Up just a bit on Wall Street today, but enough of a bit to hit a couple of new record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. White House today is that there is one more week of U.S. evacuation flights out of Kabul. 31 August is the president's deadline for U.S. troops leaving. It is going to take a whole lot longer than that, though, to sort out the things about the American war in Afghanistan that did not go as planned. Our slice of that today is the drug trade. Afghanistan is the world's biggest supplier of illegal opium, despite Washington spending almost $9 billion over the past couple of decades to change that. Jeffrey Clemons is an associate professor of economics down at UC San Diego who has studied the economics of opium cultivation in Afghanistan. So when I talked to him the other day about this, I asked about the role opium plays in the Afghan economy.
According to estimates from the United Nations, in 2020, Afghan farmers would have received something on the order of $500 million associated with selling the opium that they've cultivated. And the estimated value of the heroin and other opiates as they cross the border out of Afghanistan and into other countries is somewhere on the order of $2 billion. Hmm. So that amount accounts for something like 10% of its overall GDP.
Okay, here's the thing. The American government spent billions of dollars over the past 20 years trying to eradicate the opium trade. Obviously, it has failed. First of all, was that a fool's errand?
Yes, I think it was a fool's errand, in large part because the cultivation of opium poppy by Afghan farmers and then the trafficking of that opium and heroin out of the country is something that unfortunately just has made sense in terms of economic fundamentals within Afghanistan. Should I take a minute to unpack that?
Yeah, that'd be great, actually.
Sure. So you know, when we think about why Afghanistan has played such a major role in the global trade in opiates, there are a few, you know, in some ways very mundane reasons why that's the case. So for one, the agricultural land in Afghanistan is not that great, and opium poppy turns out to be a pretty hardy crop. A second issue is that the infrastructure in Afghanistan is quite bad, which means that there's more risk than you might expect for cultivating relatively perishable crops. Opium tends to be relatively non-perishable, and it's also pretty lightweight for the, you know, for the cash value. And then finally, opium poppy is incredibly labor-intensive to harvest. And so an economy like Afghanistan's, where there, you know, there isn't a lot of high-tech capital associated with the agricultural sector, ends up being a place where opium poppy tends to thrive. And so the U.S. and international effort to suppress the opium trade is trying to push against all of these, you know, pretty basic economic fundamentals, making it, as you said, a fool's errand.
Right, right. You can't sort of beat the market, as it were, right?
Indeed.
So now the Taliban's in charge for the second time in 20 years. A lot of the revenue that they get from opium, to be had from opium, rather, is about taxation. Do I have that right?
That's correct. So there's sort of a mix of things, you know, which are understood to varying degrees. First, it just straight up taxes farmers in the same way that you might expect any other government to tax farmers or other producers. Mm-hmm. The part on which there's sort of less information is, you know, the extent to which the Taliban or its affiliates are directly involved with the kind of trafficking stage of getting the processed opium and heroin out of the country. There's probably a mix of tangential involvement, but also just continuing to kind of tax the trafficking organizations that are actually executing the process.
Right. The question is, have they vertically integrated the Afghanistan opium industry, right? Is that the deal?
That's right.
Right. Do you suppose, and look, this is one of those unknowables, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you suppose things might have been different for our effort there if the United States had thought about opium a little bit differently?
I do think so. Although, of course, it's very hard to, you know, to quantify how important that might be. But the, you know, when in the mid-2000s, the U.S. substantially increased its expenditure on the effort to suppress the opium trade. And what we saw after that effort increased was that the national production estimates, you know, barely budged. If anything, they sort of went up over the long run. But then even more importantly, we saw that production of opium declined in the areas that the government did actually have control in, and they rose in the areas where the Taliban exerted more of its control. And so this is a really bad outcome in the sense that the opium suppression effort, if anything, kind of increased the Taliban's market power. Hmm. in the global opium trade.
And now, of course, the Taliban is sort of reaping the benefits of that, right?
That's right. And of course, on the more micro level, you know, if you just think about the long run effort to, you know, to win hearts and minds, so yeah. to speak, what part of what's going on in this process is that the opportunities for households that were inclined to cultivate opium poppy and that might have been favorably disposed to the government, they saw their opportunities reduced by the opium suppression effort, whereas the households in the Taliban-controlled areas, if anything, saw, you know, their opportunities rise. And so, you know, in addition to just the economics of how much is the Taliban profiting from the opium trade, the effort to win hearts and minds was also clearly kind of adversely affected by this effort.
That's an interesting historical ring to that phrase, hearts and minds. I'm just saying.
Indeed.
I'm just saying. Jeffrey Clements, he's a professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego, just down the road. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
You order something from a retailer, it gets picked off a shelf, stuck on a truck or a boat or a plane, and eventually, however many miles it has traveled, that package has to cross the last mile to get to your front door or carport or mailroom. And that last mile is often the most challenging, which is why it's of note today that there is a new and very big participant in that last mile market, Walmart, is expanding its delivery service to handle shipments from other businesses or even local retailers. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The last mile of delivery tends to be the most expensive, says Vince Castillo, who teaches logistics at The Ohio State University.
Because it's the hardest to get the most route efficiency, the most amount of revenue that you can't get out of an entire delivery route.
But Walmart has already solved that problem in many rural areas, where it's already making last-mile deliveries of its own products. The company's new Go Local service announced today.
What it does is it allows them to be able to make more deliveries with the infrastructure they already have.
And for any businesses that might be uncomfortable having their products delivered out of a Walmart van, the retailer is promoting Go Local as what's called a white label service.
Which means someone coming up to your door is not going to have a Walmart shirt on, okay?
Kathy Robertson is president of Logistics Trends and Insights, a market research firm.
It could be Betty's Bakery, you know, as a consumer receiving those baked items or what have you. Have no idea that Walmart is behind this.
Walmart will charge retailers for the service, but it will also get something else that's incredibly valuable, data.
Whether it's understanding which neighborhoods tend to prefer certain products versus other products, or what time of day people tend to buy products, or which products are bought together.
Tom Derry is CEO of the Institute for Supply Management.
So data becomes really critical in understanding consumer purchasing patterns and being able to better serve the consumer.
And being able to better sell to the consumer. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Serving the consumer is what we do, too, and we do it early in the morning with David Brancaccio and the gang at the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out, would you? Coming up.
I thought, do I really want a full-time job?
It's a question of time, you know? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 30 points today, less than a tenth percent, ended things at 35,366. The NASDAQ added 77 points, a half percent, 15,019. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, about a tenth percent there, 44.86. The Food and Drug Administration's approval of Pfizer's vaccine continued to lift things a little bit. Travel stocks closed higher, no surprise. Delta Airlines up 3.3%. United jumped 3.4%. Southwest up 4.3%. Today, Best Buy jumped 8.3%. The electronics retailer posted better than expected earnings and profits in the second quarter. Bond prices went down. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note went up 1.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Big shipping news today. Big green shipping news, actually. The biggest container shipping company on the planet, Maersk, out of Denmark, says it has ordered 8 new ships that are going to run on methanol. Specifically, Maersk says carbon neutral methanol. Green does come at a price, though. The ships are going to be 10 to 15% more expensive than conventionally powered marine diesel models, about $175 million apiece. But Maersk points out that it's trying to get to a fully carbon neutral fleet by 2030. And that, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, is good timing because shareholders and consumers are getting environmentally antsy.
Currently, container ships burn what's called bunker oil to get where they need to go.
And of course, when you burn bunker oil, you make sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, and also particulate matter.
Soot, says Surya Prakash. He's a chemistry professor at the University of Southern California.
With methanol, it can be very green because methanol is a very good transportation fuel. The emissions are clean. It does not make any sulfur oxides. It does not even make nitrogen oxides.
But he says one key to Maersk's mission of becoming carbon neutral is making sure the methanol it uses is itself green. China makes a lot of methanol from coal. Green methanol can be produced, for instance, directly from biomass. But Jeffrey Rissman at the NGO Energy Innovation says that's half the equation.
You need to be able to produce zero carbon methanol, and then you need to have the ships equipped to burn it.
Maersk says the vessels will be produced by South Korea's Hyundai Heavy Industries, and they'll be able to run on methanol and also on normal bunker oil, sort of a hybrid ship. The company said a major push in the move to zero carbon came from the firms they do business with. Dan Sperling, an environmental engineering professor at UC Davis, says it makes sense.
Walmart, Amazon, you know, all these companies that are consumer facing, they're getting a lot of pressure on them from both stockholders as well as consumers to reduce their carbon footprint. And so they're putting the pressure on shipping companies.
And he says the shipping industry has long taken a backseat to cars and trucks in the blame game over air quality.
In places like Los Angeles, a big part of the pollution now is now coming from the ships that are sitting there in the harbor.
He says this is a good thing for local air pollution and for public health in general in cities near ports, too. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here's another green energy story, also out of Texas, as it happens, where the deregulated energy market means people have lots of choices in picking an electricity provider. Most people, anyway. In Houston, households with less disposable income often wind up paying higher electricity rates. And the U.S. Department of Energy says that nationwide, low-income households spend more of their income on home energy costs than households farther up the chain do. And of course, those households have a harder time picking clean energy companies. In Texas, though, there is a startup that is trying to meet that need, as Houston Public Media's Kate Watkins tells us.
Antonio Martinez has lived in Houston's Gulfton neighborhood for the past 25 years, where he teaches English as a second language. And like many Houstonians, he dreads the summer spikes in his electricity bills.
Electricity is always a concern, especially in the heat, you know, the summer months.
And so he started researching different solutions. He says he got involved in a local heat mapping project and talked to his landlord about making the building more energy efficient. At one point, he decided to turn off his apartment's central AC.
I actually bought a window unit to save money.
He says it's much cheaper just to cool the area where he sleeps, although it can be a little bit louder.
Louder than a regular hum.
So Martinez was interested when a fledgling company called EnergyWell Texas reached out about a pilot program. Their pitch? Save money on your electric bill while also switching to a 100% renewable plan. Co-founder Greg Rosen says the idea came about through a research grant funded by the U.S. Department of Energy.
The purpose of the grant is to enable low and middle income community residents to switch to 100% green power and to make those residents more safe during emergencies.
EnergyWell Texas is able to offer 100% green power by buying vouchers from renewable energy companies like wind and solar. For an initial six-month pilot program, it partnered with a retail electricity provider to design a renewable fixed-rate plan and switched over a small number of households, including Martinez. Rosen says he was expecting to see savings of about 5 to 10%.
And we found that we were saving them a lot of money, 30%. One pilot participant was over 40%. On their energy bill.
He says the biggest savings tended to be for those who hadn't changed their electricity plans in several years, and so were paying high rates. And those savings can make a big difference to low-income families. Roughly 3.8 million households in Texas spend about 10% of their income on electricity. That's according to Dana Harmon with the Texas Energy Poverty Research Institute.
People who are struggling with high energy burdens are forced to make trade-offs with limited resources.
She says food and clothing tend to be the top two things people forego to keep the lights on.
And we fear that sudden spikes due to heat waves or other extreme weather make those trade-offs more severe. And the more frequent they're coming, the more difficult it is for families to keep up.
Extreme weather can also lead to extended power outages, which causes its own set of problems. That's why emergency preparedness is the second thing EnergyWell Texas is trying to address. Residents can lease a backup solar-powered battery that can charge medical devices, boil water in an electric kettle, or run a fan. Antonio Martinez had been given one of the backup batteries right before the winter storm hit Texas in February. He says he lost electricity for 4 days, but was able to power some essentials.
I was using the battery to, you know, to charge my gadgets and my neighbor's phones.
Martinez estimates he ended up saving about $15 to $20 a month on his electricity bill. He was also brought on as a community advisor for the company to help spread the word to his friends and neighbors. EnergyWell Texas aims to launch statewide by the end of the year. In Houston, I'm Katie Watkins for Marketplace.
It's been a long, very slow slog, and we will get another reading day after tomorrow. But first-time claims for unemployment benefits have been trending down since April of last year. Yes, it's a sign the economy is improving, but it's also a reminder that millions of people have lost their jobs in the past 18 months and so have had to ask themselves, what's next? In today's installment of our series, My Economy, Carol Robleski in Florence, Massachusetts, answers her own question.
Last fall, I was laid off from a job I'd had for about a year. And so I went on unemployment right away. And, you know, I have to say I was really worried because I'm not a young woman anymore. I'm an older woman. And I felt that my job prospects might be pretty limited. And I thought, well, what could I do from home that would make sense? And, you know, I had done some on-air radio work. I've done a few film narrations. And I thought, well, what the heck? I'll try voiceover. I'll just see how it goes. And so I, you know, bought a ton of equipment. I invested in some workshops and some coaching. Right now I'm sitting in a closet that has a lot of acoustical blankets hung up. I had a lot of people come and, you know, drill nails in my walls and set up all kinds of foam and stuff like that and tried. The hard part is getting a studio space that has the sound quality that you need, especially for things like audiobooks. They're very particular, and that was sort of my goal when I started this. I sent in three audition tapes. Didn't get the job, but they say, you know, it's a numbers game. You just need to submit a lot of auditions. And then this job at Smith College opened up. I applied for it, and I thought, do I really want a full-time job? I thought, I don't know. I wanted to be able to keep doing what I was doing. But, you know, the practicalities of life are such that I'm a single woman. I have two kids in their 20s. I need the health insurance. And it was just the right move to take the job. Crafting an audiobook is something very new, and it takes a lot of nuance and time. So I felt like, okay, I'm not really ready to take that challenge on yet. But when I really added all up, it was more than I really wanted it to be. It was about $4,000. But that's another reason why I thought, okay, if I don't do this, I've basically thrown $4,000 away, and that hurts. So... now that I'm back in the studio, it just feels really fun to be here, and I have some work to do to get my audio in better condition, but my hope will be in mid-September to give it a try again.
Same, 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 Carol. Same, same, same. Carol Robleski, she's in Florence, Massachusetts. We can only do this series with your help and your stories, so please let us know how your economy is doing. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, the last for this year after Kimberly's final yesterday on the beverage that has somehow come to symbolize the season we are not actually even in yet. It comes to us from my mother. Dear Kai, she emailed this morning, just thought you should know, Starbucks pumpkin latte is back. I expect a few succinct remarks. Read this important subject. Love ya, Mom. Trolled by my mother. All right, super quick, your moment of economic context. The subhead here is Nothing Matters. Ticker symbol GME, up 27% today. The company, GameStop. The reason, I have no idea. Our digital and on-demand team includes Siobhan Brett, Ufuk Mematolu, Janet Wynn, and Donna Tanz. Tarn Yeves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.